CataractCoach.com, podcast number 24, today with Dr. Rosa Bragamele. Dr. Bragamele is an ophthalmologist and professor at the University of Toronto, where she's taught residents for 25 years. She's a fantastic surgeon. You'll recognize her name because she was one of my panelists for that ASCRS Best of the Cataract Coach course. She's no stranger to being on the podium and really treats from the heart, and you'll like that she just tells you about all her trials and tribulations, what are the challenges she's overcome in her career, and what are the pearls she can offer you for you to succeed in your career. Check it out. I want to welcome you guys back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and this week we have Dr. Rosa Bragamele from Toronto, Canada. Rosa has been at the forefront of ophthalmology, anything anterior segment, especially cataract related, for the last couple of decades. I've learned so much from her, and I've gotten to know her as a dear, close, personal friend for the last probably 20 years. And I want to invite her on this podcast so that we can all learn together, and I think you'll find most fascinating is her path in ophthalmology and the way she's overcome so many challenges to be the leader that she is today. Thank you, Rosa, for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Uday. I can't imagine anyone else I'd rather talk to.
Yeah, I mean, it's the nice part here is that I'm literally talking to my sister.
Yes.
Like, I've known you for so long. We've done so much together. It's been such an incredible journey together. But boy, were we young when we first started this.
Yes, very young. I can't believe it. This year marks my 25th year graduation from residency. And so I feel 25 in my head many days, although my body constantly reminds me I'm not. But it's hard to believe that I've been in this game, teaching, treating patients, speaking at the podium, for more than 20 years. It's really quite amazing. It really, I blinked and I'm here. And it's always astounds me as to how much I've done and how much I still have to do. And sometimes, some days, how little I really know. So,
that's a great point. I tend to think of it as like ophthalmology is like the beginning of your career, kind of the middle, yes, and towards the end.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful that we're somewhere in the middle still, not kind of towards the end. But it's interesting how our outlook changes, yeah, our desires change. And can you take us through that? What changed from the 30-something-year-old Rosa to the, dare I say, 50-something-year-old Rosa?
No. I think wisdom and just experience and realizing, yeah, what's really important in life. And not that I didn't know when I was 30. I knew that I loved my kids tremendously when I was 30 and when I started my podium career and when I started my practice. I had two young boys, and I still knew that I wanted to be, number one, a really great mom. But I also knew that I had a lot to give my profession and my patients. And so it was a real balancing act back then to be there for my kids, but be there at the forefront of my profession. And so the person who suffered the most, to tell you the honest truth, during those years was me. I failed to take care of me. Yeah. And what I learned as years went by, that if I take a step back from being a doctor, I don't lose my knowledge. I don't lose my practice. I don't lose my patients. And if you now take a step back from being a mom, my kids are always there for me. They will always love me. And I can spend some me time and really have true balance or harmony in my life. And that's what's changed for me. I'm still go. I'm just not go, 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 like I was when I was 30. I've got to do it all. Now I've got to do what's important and what makes me smile.
Those are such great points. I mean, we kind of grew up together in this ophthalmology, yeah, public world, and I think you handled it better than I did in the 30s. I made some really just big mistakes of doing too gung-ho ophthalmology and traveling the planet every other week versus like missing some key milestones from my own kids.
Yeah.
And so it's a tough balance. So, you know, for your young, there are a lot of young 30-something-year-old, 40-something-year-old ophthalmologists who love this podcast, love our Cataract Coach channel, and are looking for, like, advice. How do you figure out that balance? You, your practice, your teaching world, your kids, your everything.
Well, you know, I think you have to say to yourself, what am I trying to get out of everything I'm doing? And why am I doing it? Am I doing it because my parents expect me to do it? Am I doing it because my partner expects me to do it? Am I doing it because my colleagues expect me to do it? Or am I doing it because I want to do it? And that's the first thing you have to figure out. If you can figure that out, it's not always easy to figure out. You have to do the things you love. So at the beginning of your career, it's a little easier to sort of morph into different roles and see what makes you happy and gives you joy. So try academia if it's available to you, try private practice, talk to friends, do a little bit of everything, but really choose in your first 5 years out in practice what makes your heart happy, what makes you want to go to work, what makes you want to do it, right? I think that's really important. I mean, I've taught residents for 25 years. Since I graduated, I've been a teacher at the University of Toronto. And what I tell all my residents, the most important thing in life, to tell you the honest truth, is family. And family doesn't necessarily mean a spouse. It doesn't necessarily mean kids. It might just mean a partner. It might mean friends. Friends can be your family. And some people find family within the ophthalmology teaching circuit. And that's why you see so many people at the podium, because they have become their family. Like, you've become family to me, Uday. And those are the joys from speaking at the podium, are you and Deepi and Kathy McCabe and many other people that have become close friends to me. But my family makes me happy most of the time, if they're not being jerks, my sons. But most of the time, they bring me joy. So I had to find that balance. At the beginning of your career, when you're younger, you have a lot more energy, way more than I do at 50 plus right now. But so you can do a little bit more, experience a little bit more. But I tell my residents, don't have any regrets about the time you spend with yourself or with your family, because those are moments you'll never get back. You can always be a great ophthalmologist. I've seen ophthalmologists at the beginning of their career spend their time with their family, do their practice, and then come back, like you did, Uday, for you took some time off, right? And you came back and you did, you know, the cataract coach and the speaking opportunities and all of that. I had the opportunity at the beginning, and I somehow managed to balance it with raising my kids. Saying no to some things is okay too. I think specifically women have a hard time saying no, because they think if they say no, then they'll be seen as diminutive and not able to do what the guys are doing. But saying no, you don't have to say no, I'm staying home because I want to go to the gym or I want to see my kids. You can just say no, I'm sorry, I have another engagement. And so you can say no, but think of me again, and then pick a time, do it when it's convenient for you. You need to take time. You need to take vacation. You need to take time for yourself every day. And if you don't, you will burn out. That's period. There's no question in my mind.
Wow. Probably the most profound thing in that whole explanation was the power of saying no.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that earlier on in my career, but I understand it now, and I will give our audience my favorite line, which is completely true. When someone asks me, can you participate in this project or write this chapter or be involved in this lecture or travel here, I say, thank you for the kind opportunity, but at this time, I can't give your project the bandwidth and attention that it deserves.
That's a great way of putting it. I love it.
And so therefore, yeah, please consider me for a future project. But at this point, I'm going to have to kindly say thank you and bow out.
Exactly. 100%. I think that's a great way of putting it. The other way I put it is also thank you. Always say thank you. I appreciate it. I'm so honored that you thought of me for this project or for this speaking engagement. However, I have a previous commitment at that time. And unfortunately, right now, it's not going to work. However, I say the same thing. Please think of me and circle back at another time. And as long as you do that, they don't need to know that your commitment is that your kids have a school show and you don't want to miss it. You know what I mean? Or, you know, that it's their birthday, or that you're just done because you've been working in the office. We're all burnt out from COVID. Let's put it out there. COVID has burnt us all out. We've all been working super hard post-COVID to try to make up numbers, try to help our patients.
Sure.
And we are the last people that are thanked. I feel that sometimes patients don't think of us as human beings. And that's the hardest thing. I mean, my patients don't understand why I'm not working 7 days a week and 24 hours a day when they're off work. So it's convenient for them to come and see me. And so you have to set your guidelines early on in your career. I'll tell you the one thing I did in my career was that I only ever worked a 4 day week, ever.
Oh.
I saved Fridays as an academic day. So if that meant I write a paper, I do research, I do a presentation, or I go to the spa, nobody needs to know, but that was my day to catch up so that I wasn't catching up at night when my kids were home.
That is so smart. I am unfortunately not that smart. So I used to do, I'm just not. I used to do 6 days a week, and I used to do a 2 days a week, a night clinic until 8 p.m. I'm so crazy.
You really
but
are.
But then you're right. The pendulum swung the other way, and then I actually said, I cut way back. I did no meetings for a few years, did only family stuff. Anytime there was an ASCS Academy, I'd take my family on a vacation somewhere.
Yeah.
And you know what? You're right. Ophthalmology's still here. So I like that idea of prioritizing not just your family, but yourself.
Yeah, 100%. You know what I say, because I, you know, as you know, and I'm sure we'll segue into this, but I have a very big fitness background as well. And I have all my life taken fitness very seriously because it makes you healthier. It's good for your mental health. It's good for your body. It's good for your soul. And it's good for your family. And people go, well, Rosa, you're so busy. You work at the office, you're in the OR, and then you're, I see you there with your kids all the time. You're at the school, you coach your kids, you do this. How do you have time? Well, if you have time to sit on the couch and watch Netflix for an hour, or you have a time to, God, do you ever get stuck in the Instagram scroll of all the, I watch dog videos and workout videos, and then it's 2 hours later, and I'm like, I know how I'm going to grow my biceps, but I'm never getting those 2 hours back in my life. So
yeah, for sure.
We all get caught in that. So what you have to consciously do is say, 5 days a week, I'm going to put this time aside, put it into your schedule if you have to, that I'm either going to go to the gym, I'm going to go for a walk, I'm going to go for a run, I'm going to cycle, I'm going to sit down at my easel and paint, I'm going to do something. I prefer fitness because I think there's so much more to fitness than just mental health. But anything that's going to give you an hour of mental health for you, that's not ophthalmology, that's not your kids, that's not your spouse or partner or whomever is your significant other in your life, that is you time. Because when you have an hour of you time every day, that makes you a better mom or dad, makes you a better friend, a better partner, a better doctor. You're way more patient because you've taken the time for yourself, right? And it's once you find the time, I'll tell you, you never want to give it up again.
Right. And you become unbeatable in arm wrestling. Message out there to every ophthalmologist.
Right. This one.
No matter your age, your gender, your whatever, do not challenge Rosa to an arm wrestling contest.
That's
I mean,
funny.
I will admit, you haven't beaten me.
No, I haven't.
But I'm one of the rare exceptions.
But that, I think just getting into that mentality that there has to be you time. And I tell my young residents and young grads, find the time for you. And you have to do what you have to work with people you want to work with. Don't let anybody bully you. Great words of wisdom really come from my senior partner, who's been my partner for 25 years. Because when we started, rather than him being selfish and saying, you need to work like this, this, and this, because you're working with me and you need to contribute to the office, he said, you need to think of yourself. Because if you're happy, then the office is happy, and then I'm happy. And he was very good that way with me. And I'm the same way with any juniors that come in or anyone I teach. There are things you need to do, but then you also need to take care of yourself.
Now, I want to mention resident teaching now because we're beginning of the academic year. We're recording this in August.
Yes.
And sometimes residents are almost too good at work-life balance.
Oh, okay. Yes. We have some of those now, too. I mean, in general, I love my residents. I love what I do.
Of course.
I think residents have changed over the years, and the residency has changed. And it's been for some good for the residents. I mean, when you and I went to residency, there really weren't all the guidelines that there are today. I mean, I know I worked a ton of hours that now they would not work, right? It would be seen as service.
Right.
And they wouldn't do it. But yes, there are some that feel that they're entitled and that they should be given cases and they shouldn't earn cases. And that's the difference. You always still have mm-hmm. to earn what you're going to get. What I say to my residents is, number one, with me, and I'm very candid, and as you know, with anybody in my life, I shoot very much straight from the hip. I say, number one, if I'm there, you're there. So if the OR day starts at 8, but I'm there at 7:30, you should be there at 7:30. Because if I can be there, you can be there to get the room prepped, to set the tone for the OR so the nurses know you're serious. Because if you're late, the tone for the room is, she doesn't care if she finishes on time. She doesn't care if we take a break. She doesn't care, right? So they need to be there caring. I also tell the residents, we are insignificant in the room as ophthalmologists because our nurses, our techs, our AAs, our anesthesiologists, we cannot do the job without them. So we treat the room like gold. And that's what's important, is being a team player, 100%. Yeah. A lot of them think me, way too much, like you said. And we have to think of teamwork in the OR. And I set those ground rules. And the third thing I say is, if you can't listen, because God gave you one mouth and two ears for a reason, if you can't listen to how I'm teaching you, I can't teach you, and so you can leave.
Yeah.
And if you can listen, I can teach you anything, because I can take you from being a sort of good surgeon to a good surgeon. But if you want to go from a good surgeon to a great surgeon, you have to have humility, and you need to be able to listen, and at any point, you need to be willing to learn. Because guess what, Uday? I still learn from you. I learn from David Chang. I learn from Bobby Osher. I learn from so many people. And I think I'm pretty top of my field, and I still learn.
Yeah, that's the beauty. I mean, we all learn every day.
Right.
From making these Cataract Coach videos, coming on 2,000 of them.
Wow.
I learn more than I contribute, for sure.
Yeah. And they I think they get to a level where they feel like they know, and they don't want to listen, and they're in a comfort zone. And I think if I was going to tell any resident that's watching this, and any young staff that's watching this, is that you need to be able to learn and adapt. Because how much have we adapted over our 25-year career? Like, there's been so much new technology that has come through that we've had to adapt and change and figure it out. And when you're in your residency, you're in a golden age of where you can see so much and learn so much without the responsibility that we have to our patients. So it's an opportunity to learn.
No, such good points. I think, yeah, you summed it up very nicely. I mean, the residents, you have to lose any sense of entitlement.
Yes, 100%.
You've got to be an absolute team player. And for goodness sakes, you got to show up early.
Yes.
100%. That was my biggest pet peeve. I would say, we're going to have a meeting tomorrow at 7, not 7:01. Do you get it?
What they don't realize is, you know, my husband is a chef as well. And he said he'd go to chef school and the class would start. It would be like a working class, right? You'd be cooking something that day. And if the class started at 7 and you were not in the room at 6:59, the doors were locked and you were not allowed in until the first break at 7:45. And you missed all that stuff and the prof did not care. You needed to find someone to tell you what went on, and you did not have that prep time ever again. And that's kind of how I feel. Like, if you can't bother to contact me and see what's going on in the OR the day before because you're too busy doing what, I don't know. If you can't be there early and be present during every case, whether you're doing the case or I'm doing the case, because I'll tell you, in my day, I learned a lot by watching. I mean, heck, look at what you're producing. We still all watch videos and try to learn from them. And three, if you can't follow up and see how your patients are doing, how are you going to ever learn?
Right.
You're never going to grow. And so that's what we have to remember. And You know, it's very funny. I had a very excellent resident who I love and adore. I won't say a name. And they, I won't even say he or she, and they had done over, our residency program gives residents anywhere from 700 to over 1,000 cases. That's how many they
all
get.
All cataract.
All cataract by the time they graduate. They got glaucoma.
And that's in
five years. So they only operate in their fourth and fifth year, though. And it's very intense. They get a lot of cases. They get challenging cases with certain staff. Like, I give away a lot of challenging cases. So it's fantastic, right? So this resident had had almost 1,000 cases, felt they weren't cocky, but they were like, I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. So they were doing a case, and I sort of said, I don't think you should be doing that. No, I think it's okay. I don't think you should be doing that. You know, 1,000 versus 25,000 cases. But okay, you go ahead, you keep doing that. And they had a complication that we saved. Sure. And the patient ended up doing just fine. And the eye will humble you. That's the moral of that story, that if you become cocky and think you know more and don't watch for all the signs of something going sideways, the eye will humble you and bring you to your knees, no matter how many cases you have.
One of my favorite sayings I would tell a resident, oh, really? Apparently you know more than the professor. Please, show me.
Exactly.
And our residents, listen, the great ones finished with 300 cases. So it's even a bigger markedly bigger difference.
Yes, exactly. And I only finished in my day with 350 or 370 cases. So you don't need numbers to be good. You need quality to be good, and you need to pay attention, right?
You got to learn from every single case. I think this is the key.
Exactly. Exactly. And you need to go home and watch your videos. Tape your cases, watch your videos, see what you could do better next time. And the residents that do that become great, amazing. Like, I would let them do my eye. And the residents that don't do that, you know what? There's nothing. When I had to give up about 10 years ago, because I wanted to produce, you know, mini me's, was that not everybody's going to have that need to be perfect or that need to have that, you know, ability to drive and do all of that and want perfection out of a case. And say that, you know, sometimes we just have to say we're going to produce okay residents, but that's up to them. That's not for my lack of trying. That's up to them. And some people just won't have it, and that's okay. But the people that want to have it and take it, you really need to listen and you need to be present. And the biggest thing I say is you need to listen. I can't say that enough times, because you can learn from watching. And if I'm teaching you while you're operating, listen, because you will learn.
Right. Wow. They don't realize you finish your training. Next thing you know, you look to your left, you look to your right. There's no one there to bail you out.
Nobody there. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard, but they'll get it eventually.
No, it was an amazing, I also, like you, followed in your footsteps. I taught residents for 22 years, but I actually stopped last year. Retired last year.
God bless you.
Residents were great. No, I love the residents. Love the patients. Love the nurses. I'm just so done with the administrative and bureaucratic grief, though. And that's changed a lot.
Yeah, it's tough. I've been in academia for 25 years since I graduated, and I've been lucky. I really get along with my chairman and program director, and I've been blessed in that respect. Mm-hmm. But the bureaucracy is tough. It's all the ancillary stuff that you need to do. And the financial compensation is not as great. And you can't do as many cases. And you're basically teaching for free or at a loss. And it's really got to be a vocation to be an academic. And it's not just research. To be an academic teacher in surgery is a tough job, but a very rewarding one. Because what I say is, why do I teach? A lot of people go, why do you teach, Rosie? You could be in private practice. You could have your, you know, people would come for your name and everything. And I go, I teach because it does give me joy. It makes my heart happy for the most part. It still does. Now, one day it might stop, and that's when I'll stop like you do. But it gives my heart joy. Because for every resident that graduates that remembers the way Rosa does surgery or says to me, comes up to me at a meeting, you know, a year or two later, when I was doing surgery, I remember your voice in my ear and I saved the case because I remember what Rosa taught me.
Right.
That is so, it's an amazing feeling. And what it does is it allows me to realize that I'm not just treating the patients I treat, but every resident that takes away from my teaching, I'm helping that many more patients over time.
Right.
And yeah. So I think the brush stroke of my life is a little bit longer by teaching residents. I mean, of course, then the coronary artery impact has made my life a little shorter, so I'm not sure. But
that's why you exercise so much.
Yeah, I've got to counteract the resident coronary artery spasms.
Yeah. No, I mean, in the operating room, you know, to me, nothing would faze me. I would tell the residents, if you want to know, you do that complicated case with the resident, you'd be there in the scrub of the OR for an hour. And they'd say, what's it like to be an attending? I said, let me tell you. Take your video, go home today. Wear a scrub gown, wear some gloves, put a mask, sit in front of your TV on an uncomfortable stool, with a little squirt bottle in your hand, and watch the video in real time from start to finish. That's what I just did. And then keep talking and have the person who's driving, i.e. operating, ignore you.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah, it's, but you know, you made such an impact. I know that you won teaching awards over the years, multiple of them. So you made an impact on those people. And those are people that will never forget you, right? They're going to be
absolutely
indebted to you for your teaching. And just like you're doing, like, I don't know if everyone knows, I'm going to put a plug in for Uday because I'm sure he doesn't plug himself in any of these podcasts. But these editing of videos, Uday puts out a video every single day for everyone to learn from. Right? That's a lot of work and a lot of time that you are spending still teaching. So you're still a teacher. Even if you're taking other people's videos and doing it, you're still teaching, my friends. So you still, have that bug.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We all have that bug. I just want to get all the secrets out. I want to have like no secrets left in ophthalmology. Any of those surgical pearls and secrets, I'm giving them all away.
Good.
Absolutely.
We should be sharing them.
Now, you talked earlier about, that's why you have to work out to balance the coronary artery disease, jokingly. But now, you gave an amazing ASCRS talk.
Thank you.
A named lecture about your passions and kind of your path in ophthalmology, and including your newest passion, which is, amazingly, bodybuilding.
Yes. Yeah, so I started...
Tell us about that.
I've always been an athlete. You know, I've used to sprint when I was younger in races, and then through med school I did a little bit of weight training and running, and then I started karate and I did some half marathons, and I did my second degree black belt in Shotokan karate. Always a bit of a gym rat, a little bit in the gym, and then at the age of 49, just about 8 months before my 50th birthday, I said, I wonder if I've got it in me to be a bodybuilder and truly, truly do it all. And I don't think people, like, not a steroid using bodybuilder. Obviously, I'm too old, also a female, and I know all the health issues with any assisted bodybuilding with steroids or testosterone, but a natural bodybuilder. So I am a natural bodybuilder. I do supplement, but with natural supplements like vitamins, some minerals, protein, creatinine, that sort of stuff, but no illegal use of bodybuilding drugs. And I thought, can I bodybuild and compete? And that's the caveat. Just going to the gym and weight training in itself is a lot of work. So I work out an hour to an hour and a half, 6 days a week. I take one day off as my rest day. Sometimes two, depending on how crazy my schedule is with ophthalmology or my kids, but always, always 5 days a week in the gym doing something athletic. So, you know, I will split my days and I will focus on a muscle and not necessarily lifting heavy, maybe doing higher weights. And what the gym does for me, what weight training or resistance training does for me, is mental health. So when I'm focused on lifting a heavier weight or focusing on a muscle group, doing a mind-muscle connection, I don't think about anything else. All my anxiety goes away because I have anxiety. I have a little bit of OCD. My OCD goes away. I am focused on me for that period of time. Nothing else plays into that window of time that I am at the gym. So it is a true mental health pill for me to weight train. The difference between weight training and bodybuilding is that bodybuilding and competing is not only resistance training, it's diet. And I learned so
much. That's the hard part.
Oh my God, that is the hardest part. And I learned so much about diet. In fact, at Sally Letson, I'm giving a talk on nutrition for a better life. And in fact, both go hand in hand. If you look at some of the studies that if you work out more, you actually tend to eat better because you will make better choices because you know how hard it is to lose any of the weight or feel good about yourself in the gym. And sugars are the enemy. They really are the enemy, and refined sugars. But I learned so much about myself and the resilience I had or on some days didn't have when it came to the diet, because following a strict diet that is not strict in your food choices, but in your main food group choices. So protein, carbs, and fats. So lean proteins, you can have any type of lean protein, your type of carbs being healthier, whole grain carbs, less sugars within your carbs, and then fats being good, healthy fats like avocado and cheeses are better choices, or meat fats are better choices than things like nuts or chips or oils and stuff like that. Those are not good choices. And I do use those choices some days on an off day or something like that. But boy, oh boy, was it. I thought med school was hard. Ophthalmology residency was hard. The hardest thing I've ever done is put weight training and nutrition together and get ready and prep for a bodybuilding competition. That was mind, body, and I'll tell you, some days I felt like my soul was being ripped out of my body, but it showed me who I was and what I had and the grit I had. And, you know, I loved it.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't give it back for anything. It's one of the best experiences I've had in my life. But for me, what resistance training does, and I've looked at all the studies and do speak on it as well, it is mental health. It's been proven. It is cardiovascular health. It is bone density for women. It's a better time with menopause, a better time with andropause for men. It is longevity. It is decreased risk of dementia development, all from resistance training. And that doesn't mean squatting 250 pounds or deadlifting. It means body weight exercises. That's really what it means. It means moving your body with a focus on moving the levers and the muscles in your body, okay? And then to that, you add a healthy diet, even the 80-20 rule, where 80% of the time you eat healthy, 20% of the time you don't think about it. That's fine within reason. And you will find that longevity is there, decreased risk of Alzheimer's or dementia. Again, cardiovascular, diabetes risk is lowered. You know, all of those things, and your mobility will be better for longer. You're going to be less likely reliant on needing a walker or having mobility restrictions when you're older. And then the most important thing I learned from all of this, and Deepi Dhaliwal talks about it a lot as well, is ergonomics. And so what weight training has done is help me build my posture, sit up tall, bring your scapula together, stop that cervical creep in the OR, focus on your lower back and not have issues that some of my colleagues have had, like, you know, slip discs and L1 and L2 or cervical disc disease or arthritis in my neck. I mean, I have an autoimmune arthritis in my small joints in my hands and feet, but not where it counts in ophthalmology because of my resistance training. And that's, I think, a very important thing for people to learn at any stage of their lives. But, like, you know, you've seen it on Instagram. I'm already training my 15-year-old who is loving athletics and has learned to eat healthy and make healthy choices on his own. you know, and he eats well, but it's just he chooses healthy food over non-healthy food 80% of the time.
Yeah. As the saying goes, lifting weights, it's for sanity, not for vanity.
Exactly.
I mean, it really is for your mental health. And I have been emailed this, and people have asked me, some young residents at some random programs have said, my attendees tell me if I lift weights, it's going to make me a worse surgeon.
Oh my God.
Big muscles will take away from my fine motor control. Can you address that for us?
Well, here we go, are the big muscles for a little girl. And that's, how do I say this? Can I say it's a load of crap on your podcast? It's a load of hooey. Even lifting the day before you're in the OR. The only thing I've ever done that has affected my performance in the OR was one time I was asked by a junior resident, I was a senior resident, to play a game of squash against them. And I did not realize they were like an amazing, amazing squash player. And they killed me and had me running all over the place. And it was muscles I hadn't used before. I'm just going to dim the lights here. And guess what? I had a tremor the next day because I had been flipping that racket around and it was muscles I hadn't used before. So I don't suggest you go and do a heavy arm workout the day before an OR if you've never done one before. But having muscles? Absolutely not. In fact, almost all my residents now have started some form of health training or resistance training because of me in the OR. And we've been known to even have push-up like contests in between cases to see which one of me or them, if they can do more push-ups, and no one has a tremor. So you're fine. Weight training will do, only thing it will do for you in the OR is make your posture better and create longevity for you in the OR. That's what it will do.
No, for sure. I'm fortunate like you. I don't have any neck, back issues, nothing can operate. I had a case 2 days ago where patient had bad kyphosis in a really weird position. I'm kind of operating a little bit odd. Didn't affect me in the least.
No. And I've done cases where I'm standing up, balancing on one foot with the phaco pedal because they've got such a bad kyphosis that the table is at such a level where I'm not tall. So I had to stand. I couldn't sit for the case because of the ergonomics of it. And I'm able to balance on one foot and phaco and do the surgery because of my weight training. My legs are very stable. So those are all things. Mind you, look, you have to do what's right for you, right? So again, you have to do what makes you happy. But I also do think for health and longevity, do a little bit of resistance training. But do what makes you happy. You don't have to train like you or me today. You just have to do a little bit of training. And I think building muscles that help support your core so that you help stabilize your back and help support your glutes or help build your glutes. So again, you stabilize your back and help build your shoulders. So your core muscles, your rhomboids in the back, doing some form of band training even there will only help you. That will not hinder you at all in the OR.
Yeah, we're so used to just focusing on the mind. But what about the body, right?
The body.
Gotta go together, all together.
You know, I don't know. I don't want to ever lose my mind. But I also don't want to lose my body. Because losing either one of them would make me extremely unhappy. And I'm not sure I would want to be around if I lost the ability to have mobility or the ability to think for myself.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. We'll definitely keep up the concept of take care of yourself, which should include some sort of at least resistance training. And as you said, it could be weightlifting. Could be just bodyweight exercise. Could be push-ups.
Could be push-ups, pull-ups. So, could be whatever you want to do. But yeah, that's what you need to do. You need to incorporate. So number one, and the key thing you said there, is you need to incorporate me time. And part of that me time will hopefully include resistance training at least 3 days a week. You know, but you need to remember yourself, because if you're burnt out, if you're exhausted, and part of all this training is sleep and quality of sleep. So if you eat better and you do a little bit of resistance training, your quality of sleep will be better. And if your quality of sleep is better, your mind is clearer the next day and you have a better day in the OR and your body heals better. So it all kind of interplays. It's all a cycle of having good quality of life.
I think we've changed though. If you think back, like early career 30s, I made the mistake personally of not probably doing enough sleep sometimes, especially at the academy meetings and ASRS meetings,
yes,
and worldwide international meetings. But now it's like mid-career, it's like, oh, you guys have fun. I think it's hitting my bedtime. I'm going to...
I think everyone is different. Like, yeah, you know, there are people that can get away with hardly sleeping at all. I don't get it. Even into their late 40s, early 50s. Yeah. And they're just made that way. I'm definitely not made that way. If I don't get at least 6 hours of sleep a night, I'm
sure
pretty much grumpy. But what I do find is you can sleep too much. So studies have shown that if you sleep more than 8 hours a night, it's actually too much,
yeah,
and it can have negative effects on you. But yeah, I remember those days where I slept 8 hours in 4 days. So...
Right.
But we were younger, right, and we could put up with it. Our bodies could deal with it better. So that is, I think, a game for the youth. But there are some older that can still do it, and God bless them. That's all I say.
Where do you think we're heading then? Because we're the same age. We're heading down the same path. Where are we heading in the next couple of decades as we move from, let's say, we're certainly just starting off in the second half of the career now.
Yeah.
We passed the midway mark.
I'm way past the midway mark.
Oh, I'm not. I'm ready to go.
Are you?
Keep going.
I'm enjoying what I'm doing right now. I have achieved very good balance for most days. Not every day,
yeah,
but for most days, I have very good balance now. I'm in a happy place. I work not 5 days a week, not 4 days a week. I work 3 days a week now. So I've earned that. But that's work in the office and in the OR. So I still work. I still do a lot of academic stuff. I still do lectures around the world. I still innovate with companies. And that's the stuff I love. So where my heart is, what makes me smile now in making a difference is not so much just making a difference teaching or treating patients. Those still allow me to have great pleasure. But where I love is to innovate. And I love working with, right, companies or with other ophthalmologists and innovate within our field. That is where I see my future going, is more so within the innovation realm. Hopefully working.
But how's that changed? If you look back at us, we both, like say 20 years ago, did a lot more of the consulting stuff with all the companies.
We did.
And it seems like now we're both far more selective.
We are, because we can afford to be. And because we want to be. Again, it's balance. So I'm not going to be traveling all around the world consulting for companies, because it's just not my thing anymore. I'm happy having me time at home, being able to educate abroad, being able to work in labs and innovate, but it has to be on my terms now, not on anybody else's terms. I think.
So, for example, in a year, how many international trips would you do for ophthalmology then, and how about now?
Oh, gosh. When I was in my 30s, Uday, I was traveling every third week.
Yeah.
The thing I did was, though, with international trips, I took one of my kids every year.
Oh, nice.
So every ESCRS that I went to when my older two children, so I, for those of you who don't know, I have a 26-year-old, a 24-year-old, and then I also have a 15-year-old. So when my older two boys were younger, like age 7, 8, 9, 10, every year I would alternate a child and take one with me to ESCRS. And I would have mommy, son bonding time with my children. It would just be me and them.
Mm-hmm.
And people within the industry that I won't name, but became great friends to my kids. My kids still remember them. Took care of my kids for me. Like, they would sit beside them in the mm-hmm. meeting hall while I was giving a lecture, while they were playing their little game, video games on mute or with their headphones on. And you know, my oldest son just came back. He's doing his PhD. He lectured in Japan. He travels around the world.
How cool is that?
Giving engineering lectures. And I said to him, he's only 20, he's going to turn 26. I said, I only started my first lecture ever when I was 27 years old and a senior resident. I went to Quebec City to lecture at the Canadian Ophthalmology Society meeting as I had received one of their awards for a research paper that I did with one of my staff. And I was pregnant with Christian. I said he caught the bug while he was in my belly as a senior resident. And he lectures around the world. My second son also is doing very well academically, loves working with people, loves teamwork, loves teaching. And he's a pharmacy student, going to be a pharmacist soon. And so it's like they were there. You didn't think they were present, but they watched and they learned and they were proud and they wanted to emulate, right? And so I think it's great if you have the opportunity to get your kids to go to a meeting with you, even if you're not speaking, even if they're just sitting there and seeing what mom and dad do at a meeting. If you're younger and you have a younger child, take them with you. Let them know what your world is like so they understand why sometimes you come home tired, what your days are, and all of that. I think that's very important. Now I pick and choose what I want to do. Now, Uday, you ask me what's different? I need balance. I need sanity. And I need to do what makes my heart smile. And that's why I don't do as much.
Yeah, I can't say I am on the same boat. I'm actually doing 10 international trips this year.
You're nuts. I'm doing international trips, but half of them are personal. So,
well, that's even more fun. But no, it's like you said. It's finding what makes you happy, what makes you tick, what
you enjoy. You got to make yourself happy. Exactly. You got to find your own personal passion. And then I'm an empty nester, and my kids live far from home.
Yeah.
And so it's a little different. I wish my kids were in the same town as me. I'd spend more time with them.
Yes, and I keep trying to talk some of my kids that it's finally time for them to move out. So I don't know what I did wrong, but they're still living with me. It's the economy and the cost of living nowadays, in Toronto specifically, is tough. But I think, you know, I say work-life balance. I've heard other people say, and I like it better, work-life harmony. So it's finding...
Oh, yeah.
You know what works for you. And I'll tell you something. 1 year, something will work for you. And then next year, it might not work for you. And that's okay. Like, you have to be fluid also in what works for you. Right? But just don't have any regrets. Try everything you want to try. Do you know how hard it was at 50 to get up on a stage with a small bathing suit on and show off my body? For someone who has body dysmorphia? Like, I was terrified, but I did it. And I learned from an experience, and I feel good that I did it. And I brought the best package I could bring, and that's all in anything you do in life. You need to just try.
Yeah, that's a great point. Plus, I think another pearl I learned from you is that, you know, life is up and down. Mm-hmm. There's some great times, some not so great times, but in the end, it's kind of like a zero-sum game. So when you're living high and life is amazing, please enjoy it because the big challenges are just around the corner.
Exactly.
And likewise, when you're down in the dumps, just hang in there. Good times are around the corner.
Well, what I say is, like, a failure isn't really a failure. It's just a failed experience that you can learn from. And if you can learn from it, and turn it around, then it's no longer a failure. I hate the word failure because we all have great moments. And this is what I hate about Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. Do you ever post your down moments? Nobody posts their down moments, right? Nobody does. And so it's a false advertising. You think, oh, they look great. And people post pictures with filters. And people, you know what I mean? So life is up and down for everybody, like you said. But don't think of it as a failure or a down. It's just a dip in the moment on your way back up. And that's all it is.
Right. I put it this way. I'm not very good at golf. But if I want to be a great golfer, there could be a day that, wow, I play amazingly well. And I'd see that as a success.
Yes.
And there'll be a day that I play terribly. And you shouldn't see it as a failure because while I didn't play very well, both that success and that failure on the same road to me finally one day in the very far future being a scratch golfer.
Wow, good for you. I'm a right, best
ball.
They're both
steps in the right direction.
That's it. They are both steps in the right direction. And the other thing is you have to remember is you can't be great at everything. But nothing right. precludes you from trying and being okay or good at it. Or maybe not good at it, but you tried it. Do you know what I mean? And so
there's
nothing wrong with not being good at something. It's okay just as long as you have fun doing it.
Exactly. And you keep learning along the way. I think
exactly.
that's the key.
Yes.
Now, speaking of learning, I want to thank you again for being the best panelist. You and Deepi Dhaliwal were amazing panelists for our ASRS Canada Coach Session. We're going to repeat this again at the Sally Letson Symposium. And of course, we're getting you back for next year's ASRS in Boston.
I hope so.
But what I loved most is the banter back and forth. And from the podium, you always shoot from the hip. You're just a straight shooter. No, you should have done this differently.
The best lesson in life is be able yeah. to make fun of yourself.
I'm good at that.
And if you can have that ability to not take yourself so seriously, you'll do really right. well. Things will bounce. Like one of my profs once said to me, like water off a duck's back. Just go with it. And you're great at that. You open yourself up to all the banter, which is wonderful. And then you just have to joke about it because we've all been there, right? We've all done it and we're all not infallible. And so we have to remember that sometimes it's just good to make fun of it because it reminds us that we're human and that's what we
right.
are.
Yeah, for sure.
You seem superhuman yeah. some days, but we're all pretty much human.
You know, as you know, it's, we all have our own struggles. It's a tough balance. I learned that too. I always think, you know, be a little nicer than I need to be to anyone because you never know what personal challenges and struggles they have. Gosh, we all have them.
That's a great point. Absolutely. And treat everyone equally. I don't care what you do for a living. It doesn't mean I have a right to treat you any differently than I would if you were my boss
right.
or you were my child. I treat everyone the right. same, and then I hope that it bounces back and everybody treats me the same as well.
Speaking of that, I had a patient who I did surgery on recently. It is one of these incredibly wealthy Beverly Hills people, and she said to me, she says, I'm so thankful, what a beautiful surgery you did for me. And she says, doctor, of all my service personnel, you and my chef are my two favorites. And I just thought, wow, that must be a heck of a chef.
Oh, God. Some people,
you know, I
never
felt happier to be a service personnel. I'll take it.
Yeah, I know. I know how you feel. But you know what? You're doing the right thing. You're doing your job, and that's all you can do. You're doing your vocation. It's not even a job for us. It's something like
right.
when my kids look at me and say, Mom, you know, is it time for you to retire? I go, it's hard to think of that word. Not because I'm holding on to my ego. It's more that I'm holding on to the fact that you and I make a difference in people's lives.
Sure.
Patients, residents, people around the world, whatever. And it'll be hard to not do that, not only because of my ego, because part of it will be ego, let's be honest. But most of it will be that it's hard to say, I'm going to stop. And then maybe that will impact people being taken care of. You know, I know there are other ophthalmologists out there, but, you know, I have made a difference. And sometimes it's hard to think that I won't make a difference in the future. And it's hard to give that up, mm-hmm. you know. And as long as you're making a difference and being good to people, then I think that's where you need to keep going. I mean, you were intuitive enough that teaching wasn't your thing anymore with residents and it was time for you to leave. And I think that was a very intuitive thing for you to do. And not to say that I might not be following in your footsteps in a few years, who knows? And if my residents are listening, I'm sorry. But you get to a point in your career where, like I said, if it doesn't make your heart happy, you can't be there anymore. And so let's see what the next few years leads. But it's always an adventure, and I'm ever changing, and I'm not ready to stagnate and stay the same way.
Right, I think that's important. You got to evolve, and it's perfectly fine to switch gears. Whether it's changing your job from this group to the other group,
yes.
Whether it's changing from an academic to private practice,
yes.
Or whether it's saying, you know what, I've had enough of the teaching of the residents, I wanted something different. Whatever it is, it's perfectly fine to switch gears. But I think one thing is important that you touched on is, you know, we have built incredible skill sets mentally and with our hands, with dexterity, to be able to make an incredible difference in the world. And on a planet where we're not training enough ophthalmologists worldwide.
Correct.
I'd hate to just think like, okay, I'm never going to operate again. That, as long as I've got the abilities and the skills.
Yes.
I don't mind. Let me go do it for free, but let me not waste what I've spent so many years of building up.
And you know, when you ask me that question of what are you going to do moving forward and what do you see yourself doing? And really, my husband asked me the same question. If you give up surgery, what would you do? And I don't think I'll ever give up surgery because I think what I would do is go on charity missions. And I know that sounds very altruistic and very pie in the sky, and I'm not trying to get any points for it at all. I don't know if it will happen, but that's what I'd really, truly like to do. When I get to a point where financially, and I'm almost there, I don't need to be working. I've really created my nest egg. I'm okay financially. I'd like to give back in a different way. So not only, you know, giving back to the patients here, the first world country patients, but maybe being able to go more and do more third world country patients that really don't have the care they need, and use my surgical skills to better that and do that around the world. Because those third world countries, if we're seeing shortages in first world countries, you know that they need it in every third world country. And being able to do that when my kids are grown and older and all the other stuff I've been doing is done, I think will be the best thing I can give back to the world and to ophthalmology. And you know what? Like, altruism is really a funny term because nothing is truly altruistic. If I'm doing it, I'm getting something out of it. So it's not altruistic. It's for me to be able to give and get from it. It will make me happy. I'll feel good about myself and feel good that my skills are still giving back.
Absolutely. And I've done more than a dozen of those international charity trips to third world countries across the globe. And what sometimes you don't realize is that it's the most difficult cataracts.
Yes.
With the most primitive equipment sometimes.
Yes.
And so you have like less than ideal conditions. You're not in your own operating room. You don't have all the fancy machines. And there is no such thing as 2+ nucleus sclerosis on those trips.
No.
It does not exist.
No. And that's why, you know, I know you do small incision, extra cap, manual extra cap. And I've done extra caps in my career. That's how I was trained to begin with. I did more extra caps than when I started than phacos. And so we're skilled surgeons in those areas. So we actually at U of T do a resident mission that the residents have to go to a third world country in their senior year and do a mission as well to give back. And I think it shows them how lucky we are where we are with what we have. And so I think it's a good thing to do. Everyone should do it if they can afford to do it and they have the time to give back. And it might be at a different points of your life. You know, and so that's where I see myself. If I give up surgery and semi-retire from ophthalmology, maybe I'll be able to give back that way.
Right, for sure. Speaking of which, for your residency programs, how many total residents are there per year, do you know, in Canada?
We have five.
Well, that's in Toronto, but how about nationwide?
Oh, per Canada, 15 to 20.
So pretty small.
It's very small.
For a population of?
We're the same population as California.
Right. Yeah. So we U.S., we're training more per capita, but still low numbers. U.S., it's about 450 ophthalmologists per year for a U.S. population of maybe like 360.
So I'm not sure how much Quebec has in some of the smaller places, but we might have a bit more, maybe 25 max per year to 30 max per year. Residents abroad across Canada. Yeah, it's not high. It's very limited.
So we all better start working harder.
Yeah, you do that. I'll watch you.
No, it's, you know, the nice part is we've gotten obviously far more efficient. So the young doctors now don't realize that, like, this is not always how it was.
Well,
we're so much more efficient. The surgery today is so much different than it was before.
It is night and day from 25 years ago. It really is with respect to turnover and cases and sterilization and what we're doing differently today than we did 25 years ago is I think we've gone backwards a little bit. I mean, we all talk about sustainability. And I know we're probably running out of time, but sustainability is a key concept. 25 years ago, we used to reflash tubing. We used to reuse phaco tips. We used to do all that. And then we were told we were doing, it was wrong. It was dangerous to the patient. It was a problem. It was going to be, so we had to go to disposable everything. And look what we've created. Right? We've created an unsustainable world with disposable everything. And, you know, going grocery shopping and not having plastic bags is not the answer when everything comes in plastic containers, right? And it's the same with ophthalmology. There is so much packaging involved, even for IOLs and their phaco sets, that it's gotten ridiculous, all the plastics we use. And because of the way the plastics are made, they're not recyclable. And so it's really turn the other direction. Yeah. So that's the thing. We've changed the world for better and for worse.
Right. Part of it too is the economics. The companies, listen, they'd rather sell disposable everything, new on every case you do.
I know, but we're running out of money too in the Canadian healthcare system. That's the biggest problem.
Well, I think it's worldwide even. I mean, just like it just financially doesn't make sense. David Chang famously did a study comparing, you know, the cost of doing a bare bones phaco to a cost of MSICS, the small incision cataract manual extraction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a 100-to-1 ratio. It's like crazy.
It is. So it is crazy. And then he also did that study comparing endophthalmitis rates with respect to reusing the same gown and the same gloves and just scrubbing over the same gloves from his study versus what they do in California. And the endophthalmitis rate was the same. So I'm not sure what we're doing with everything, with all the coverings and the gowning and the gloving and all the packaging. It's gotten expensive and it's gotten unsustainable. So let's see.
And it may, like the study has shown, may not even have any benefit.
No, exactly. That's for someone else to come. I mean, I'm going to try to help, but it's not my vocation right now. We'll figure it out.
Well, it was... Rose, I want to thank you for an incredible, you know, talk here the last hour. Any kind of final pearls you'd give to the young 30 to 40-something-year-old ophthalmologists who tend to watch this podcast? Actually, probably 30 to 50 is the age.
Okay,
the people watch this.
One day at a time.
Yeah.
Remember to listen. Remember to learn every day. And remember to take time for yourself. But don't rush everything. It will happen. Enjoy the moment. I remember every moment you and I had together laughing and, you know, talking about life more so than I have remember any moment I was on the podium and giving, you know, named lectures and stuff like that. The time I had with my friends, my colleagues, and my family, I have learned are way more important than any notoriety I had on the podium. So enjoy those times as well and make those times count.
Enjoy the journey. I love it.
Yes. Enjoy the journey. Exactly. Absolutely. 100%.
Thank you, Rosa. I want to say we had an incredible time together. I want to remind all our viewers and our listeners, we have a new podcast every single week with so many great words of wisdom. Lots of pearls for you to become a better ophthalmologist and enjoy your life even more.
Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me and Dr. Rosa Bragamili. She's been a good friend for more than 20 years, and now you can understand why I know she's such a special person. So much information for her to offer us. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Remember, there's a new podcast every week, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find the podcast, on cataractcoach.com also, and of course on our YouTube channel. We will see you next week. Remember, also drop me an email. Let me know, how are you enjoying these podcasts? And let me know if you have any ideas for future guests.